again towards the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. I was reading something the other day that someone asked Murshida Goodenough, who was one of the original Murshidas, four Murshidas, no Murshids, four Murshidas left when Murshid passed, Murshid and Icon passed. And someone asked her about this word master in invocation. And she said, well, an icon also said you could use the word message. So who formed the embodiment of the message instead of the master, because it can be, words can be catalytic or polarizing for people. So I just wanted to offer that, that was some of her advice. The title of this class today for this hour is Tuning the Heart and Taming the Mind. And who amongst us couldn't use a little more of that? When Guyon invited me to participate in the camp, I wanted to know what the camp theme was. And she said, wider circles, expanding the heart of compassion. And I wanted to offer something during our time together that had thematically tied into that. So this is a teaching from an icon, and it can be found, and I always send out a link. You'll be able to find it, I'm sure, after camp, but we also have a mailing list, and it will have the link, an active link, to the entire teaching. This is just an edited portion of it. But nonetheless, you can find it even without this document. It's Sufi Message Volume 8, called Sufi Teachings, and this is the section or the chapter called The Tuning of the Heart. And Murshid says this: there are five different aspects of spiritual attainment, which are all by the tuning of the heart. They're all by the tuning of the heart. Now there are five. I don't have time to cover all of them, but I will cover three. And these, I hope, will have some meaning for you. So the first one is the heart affected by environment. The heart affected by environment. And Murshid says this: many will object by saying, but does not our heart depend upon our everyday environment, on the circumstances of life? If the environment is not agreeable, how can we make it right? So that's the question. And I'm sure we ourselves at some point in our lives, perhaps even now under circumstances, have asked that question. And Murshid says this: indeed, the first stage of our development depends upon environment and circumstances. And here I just want to pause. I think this is a really good reason for us to do retreat, to take some time every day to set aside for daily practice, because by doing that, we create an environment and the circumstances that give fertile ground for that inner life. And we can do that even amidst our everyday life. We just scheduled it in as part of that. I know that when I've done retreats with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, he always gave these, there were certain things that you would do to make your environment conducive to retreat. And then he'd always say, of course, this isn't always possible to have these kinds of conditions, but we can practice that during retreat. And then he'd go on to say, and of course, what goes on the cushion is only part of what we really need to do. What really matters is what we do off the cushion. So having those circumstances, creating that environment, and preparing ourselves for everyday life, so, so important. So again, I'll go back just a bit. Indeed, the first stage of our development depends upon environment and circumstances. But there's nothing in the world which we cannot try to improve. Nothing. There are many things that we can help and improve if we would only try. You know, the first book I got as a child, it was on the day I started kindergarten at age 4, my grandmother Sabato brought me a book and she read it to me before I went to school. And it kind of has become my motto, probably all through life. And you, I'm sure many of you have read it. It's called The Little Engine That Could. You know, that little engine trying to go up the hill. I think I can, I think I can, I think I can, I know I can. So here Murshid is saying, but there's nothing in the world which we cannot try to improve, like the little red engine. There are many things that we can help and improve if we would only try. That try mind. Sometimes it's difficult, but often we think it's difficult while it really is not so. That we make it more difficult in our mind, but by doing, sometimes we can unravel the difficulty. Now, Murshid goes on to say that the greatest difficulty there is, the greatest one, is our loss of patience. Anyone have any issues with that? Only me? Sometimes we want to get things done quickly or move past something. So the greatest difficulty is the lack of patience. When patience is exhausted, things cannot be made better. And then they remain in the same condition. So if we exhaust ourselves and I exhaust our patience, things will just remain the same. So sometimes it takes waiting and patience, waiting for the call to come. Murshid goes on to say, but when one really wants to make one's environment better and sacrifice all one can in order to do so, then one can. So now we're talking about if one's in a life situation, which is extremely difficult, they think, I can't get out of this. But you know, Murshid's saying, yes, you can. And by doing so, you persevere, you get stronger. And it's maybe good to do that, to make some changes. So think about that if that applies to you. I think about it as it applies to me. When patience is exhausted, things cannot be made better. And then they remain in the same condition. But when one really wants to make one's environment better and sacrifice all one can in order to do so, then one can. Too often one expects from others more than they are able to give. Too often one expects more from others than they are able to give. And that makes one helpless and independent. That makes one helpless and dependent. Too often one expects from others more than they are able to give. And that makes one helpless and dependent. Now listen to this next part. This is very important. Once a person has become so independent, not dependent. Once a person becomes so independent that without the help of others, one can keep one's feelings untouched, one becomes like the sun, which burns without oil. Radiant without dependence on causes, conditions, and others. It's like the sun that gives life endlessly without asking for anything in return. So important. Once a person becomes so independent that without the help of others, one can keep one's feelings untouched. One becomes like the sun, which burns without oil. And in that, it differs from the lamps that burn with oil. For when the oil is finished in their light, when the oil is finished, their light goes out. So think about that. Touching that source of infinite light and life and being in touch with that. Not necessarily trying. He's telling us here, it's not about the environment. It's not really about the conditions. It's about an inner state. And we know that. I have a a good friend I just had lunch with her out here this week, and she's working on, she's done two films on Mahatma Gandhi. Now she's working on Kasturba, who was the wife of Gandhi, who was, he actually, Mahatma Gandhi credits her with his understanding of harmlessness and non-aggressive participation in change. It's quite an amazing story. But the point is, we're also being told that here, that we can, I've heard stories from people that, the elders in India, that there are certain people that were fighting for independence of India, such as Mahatma Gandhi, but Sri Aurobindo was another one. And people are absolutely convinced, in the most abject, awful prison conditions, that at least those two men, and I'm sure there are others, I think Nelson Mandela is another person we could say, gained this incredibly illuminated and enlightened state, even imprisoned and in the worst conditions. So it's possible. It's not something imaginary or lofty. Whether we're up for it, I don't know. Whether I'm up for it, I don't know. But there is a practice that we can work with that can help us. And that practice is called Sabur. Sabur. And I bet you, some of you know that, what that means. It means patience, divine patience. And I'm taking my time here. I'd like to read a few phrases from Physicians of the Heart, produced by Sufi Rahaniyat International. And again, I'll have a link to that on this information. But sabur is that divine power that can see things through to the end. You know, sometimes we maybe have a really big interest in something and all of a sudden we lose interest, but we don't really accomplish much if we can't see something through to the end. I have to say, on the other hand, there are some times when we used to call it in design school, beating a dead horse. You know, if the design wasn't working, it just wasn't working. So in that instance, perhaps it takes more patience to let something go and begin again. So, you know, always have to take these things and balance them in our mind and don't make them so fixed. The teachings are fluid and alive. So it's the ability to see things or stick to something through the end. And at the human level, it's to maintain a kind of equanimity. And again, Murshid would call that an interdependence, which relates to this great teaching on independence and indifference, which doesn't have anything to do with not caring. It has to do with caring immensely, but with in a very objective, non-partial way, with equanimity. So it's to persevere with equanimity the trials that come through our lives and the circumstances, to have that aspect of diligence and perseverance. And of course, I love this. Wally Ali was the editor, so all of us that know Wally Ali can totally hear him saying this. A physical plane variation of its root means to endure and to stop complaining. Because it's a nature of things. We complain about stuff. You want things different. They just are the way they are sometimes. So the invocation of Sabur is a remedy for all those who lack patience, especially on the spiritual path. And that can happen. You know, we feel we're not making any accomplishment. We're not getting any insight. We don't see the shape of our life changing outwardly. We're not having any kinds of inner experience. And we can lose heart. We can give up. But here it's saying, to keep that patience going. It's the remedy for the lack of that, especially on the spiritual path. And it helps us to defer judgment and how to forgive, teaches us how to forgive. Somewhere in Anayat Khan's teachings, it says, forgive all, but don't forget. You know, don't lose that lesson either. And somewhere else, I'm sure he says, forgive and forget. So, I mean, you have to kind of seek really deeply the teachings and take them into your heart to understand them. We all do. And then Sabur has this aspect of, just like the lamp that we were given a metaphor of, knowing, of illumination, a way that we can receive within and grow brighter and brighter. Now I'd like to read from Murshid Saadi Klotz's book called The Sufi Book of Life. And it's beautiful. Read this, or listen to this as I read it. Perhaps life is calling you on a bit longer. Persevere, stick to it. While the pathway counsels patience, it's real, and this is about Sabur, while the pathway, he always talks about the Wazifa, or the sacred names, the divine names, as pathways. So while this pathway counsels patience, its real message is this. Now is not the time to disperse your light. That is, the deep knowing of yourself and others that you have received from the One. So sometimes we receive something and we just want to share it with everybody. Sometimes we need to keep it inwardly. And Murshid Sadi says, don't hurry, let things cook a while. You know, it's like a really good stew or soup, or, you know, we had that beautiful story by Rumi, the chickpea with the getting beat down into the pot by the sheikh to cook a little while longer, to become a little more tender, become a little more delicious. You know, we can be delicious, savory. So it teaches us to be patient. And I will just say, in my own life, I was under the guidance of Murshida Vera, and I was in a dormant period for maybe up to 8 years. It didn't appear as if anything was happening, but I will say, I am, if nothing else, I'm a disciplined person, and I kept with my practices every day. I never heard anything. I didn't feel very much, and I knew this was a time of having to be very patient, because I had a sense something was coming, and I had received indications, you would say, that I had some work to do in service to the message, but it couldn't be hurried. 8 years, that's a long time in someone's life. I think it is, at least. So, you know, I kept hearing this is a gestation period, and it was, and I had to just stick with it and not give up courage and hope. So shall we work with this practice, Sabur? We'll do it 11 times aloud, and then 11 times on a whisper, and 11 times just silently inward. And when we're doing these practices on our own, if you choose to take them up, certainly Murids in our circle can do that. And if you decide you have an attunement to practice, please confer with your own teacher, your Murshida, and be sure that it's in concert and harmonious with the practices that you're currently doing. So we're going to use Sabur, patience, divine patience. Ya Sabur, Ya Sabur, Ya Sabur, Ya Sabur, Ya Sabur. Ya Sabur, Ya Sabur, Ya Sabur, Ya Sabur. Now whisper just Sabur, drawing it into the breath and out to the breath like this. Sabur, Sabur. And now silently breathe in and out. Sabur, calling forth that vibration from the atmosphere and drawing it also from the very innermost chamber of our being to be activated and enlivened. Ya Sabur. Ya Sabur. Sabur. So again, the first stage of this, something's happened here. I want to be sure I get back to my teaching. Sorry. There we go. So the first aspect was of tuning the heart is the heart affected by environment. And then we talked about, now we're going on to the heart influences nature, not it is influenced by nature, although that can be so too. But Murshid says, heart influences nature. And here he says, if we go still deeper on this subject, then you will find that it is not only human beings, but even with nature, the atmosphere, the weather, the climate, there also is the tuning of the heart. Even a flower feels it. Many people can keep flowers in their hand for a long time, while others, no sooner have they touched the flower than it fades. The fading of the flower means that it has become out of tune. There are stories of sages in the East who have, after having left a place of rest and peace where they were staying, perhaps under a shade tree or in a village, they come back after some years and they found the place in a bad state. But the moment they returned, it became fertile again and the place flourished. And what does it mean? That they were in tune. And that's where that closes, but it also means they tuned others. And by tuning ourselves, we can also tune the atmosphere, tune others. We see that perhaps even in our neighborhoods or our cities, an area that has fallen into disrepair or decline. And all it takes is one shopkeeper or someone coming to fluff things up a bit. It starts to bring everything back. It revives things. It can happen in neighborhoods too. Just one person moving in that cares and fixes the house, starts to paint and plant things. You see, others will catch it. So everyone has this capacity, not just the sages, but ultimately we are all sages. We may not know it yet, and we may not be living it yet, but we all have that capacity. We have that spark. So think about that. When you're in nature, or when you're in a neighborhood, or when you're in a shop, what is the quality of atmosphere that you're sharing with others? And I will say also, sometimes things need to be shaken up a bit. If things are not going quite right, I think it's okay to question it. I think it's okay to bring it to people's attention. It may seem harsh sometimes, but in truth, it can be very helpful if something needs to be remedied. And so it's not always just a passive thing. It can be also active. Does that make sense? So then the last aspect, which is just a little bit longer than the first two. And again, I'll check my time. I'm still doing okay. This is called sympathizing with all. And I think this is very much on topic with the theme of this camp, this retreat, sympathizing with all, having to do with the widening of the circles of compassion. And let's see if Murshid will illuminate this subject a bit more for us. So Murshid says, an icon says, there is a still higher stage of our development. And that is the attitude of going forth and sympathizing with all we meet. That's a very potent phrase. And I just want to say something here. It's not to have pity on someone. It's to attune to someone, to be sensitive to someone, but not to be destroyed or brought down by that. It's to have a sympathy, tune in, if one can, to help. If one can't, to observe and be patient. So please think of that. It's not always doing, it's sometimes witnessing. This comes by understanding. The more understanding we have of human nature, the more sympathetic one becomes. Even for those who do not deserve it, we should have sympathy. Now, we've all probably encountered or know people that have gone along a less than desirable path. But to me, that's something to really sympathize with, because they're suffering in that. But again, it's not something that we, unless it's our absolute clarity and obligation to fix or enable. But perhaps we pray and we trust that God has this individual on the right path so that they can come to some sort of self-discovery and self-realization through the experience. I think Sufis have that quality of wanting to sort of rush in and fix things. Sometimes it's not to be fixed. It's not ours to fix. Remember that, please. Back to the reading. Even for those who do not deserve it, we should have sympathy. And of course, we do, because we understand that this sympathy can arise from the understanding that someone, a person, a being, is shrouded in, or brought down perhaps, by the circumstances of life, and they don't see a way out of that. And yet, they have that divine spark always within, and trying to sympathize with that part of the being and bring that forward can be very helpful. And Murshid Ghosn says, on to say, in this way, sympathy, which is symbolical like water, spreads in time. It will expand like the water of the ocean. It becomes an everlasting spring that rises and falls, rises and falls. And Murshid gives this beautiful example, and I'd like to offer a little commentary on that. He says, Murshid Inayat Khan says, in order to teach this to the wise of India, they have turned to the river Ganges and the river Yamuna. Some people might call it Yamuna or Jumna, but it's Yamuna. And so in order to teach this principle of this ever-rising spring, this, to the wise of India, have turned to the river Ganges and the river Yamuna into places of pilgrimage, and they call them sacred. These rivers rise in the same place on the top of the Himalayas, and from there they divide and descend, becoming larger streams, and the place where they join is near Allahabad. And this is a place of pilgrimage. There are those who go there for purification of all their sins. It's like bathing in that water is like being cleansed of everything. Everything's wiped away. We're reborn, basically, when we emerge out of the water. Now, this is such a beautiful example, because some of you may be aware of that incredible image of Shiva. And Shiva's sitting there. He's sitting in an equipoise, but you can imagine that he's like a mountain. And from his head springs light, but that light then becomes two pathways that come down. That is representing Ganga and Yamuna. Those two pathways start to come down and begin crossing here, here, here. I'm at my heart, here. I'm at my navel, here. I'm at my sacral plex. I hear the root chakra, and it goes down through the legs. It also extends through the arms. So this is representing not only these rivers, but the very life force in our being, and they cross. And in India, there are also three other places where they cross, but here we can imagine that that's that energy. It's like I can't remember the term, but anyway, it's that type undulating two lines that cross over each other that describe DNA, for example. So think of that we have that capacity to have this spring rising from the heart, coming out through the top of the head. It begins to cross, cross, cross. And there are those points of pilgrimage. And those points of pilgrimage are chakras. In India, of course, it's this site near Allahabad. There's one in Hardwar. There's another place. I think there are four places, which is interesting. Four places every third year, what's called the Kumbh Mela, K-U-M-B, Kumbh, you say it like that, means nectar. And Mela is festival. So every 3 years, there is a Kumbh Mela. And then there's a huge Kumbh Mela on the 12th year. So it's interesting also because Anayat Khan teaches us about this. He relates it to music. He relates it to levels of initiation. So these numbers and these meanings are very hidden. But as you study and as you practice, things start to become revealed. But think of this, that we have this capacity to have this energy of these two great rivers within our being. And they're represented by that beautiful image of Shiva. And on the little picture on our website, you see the male and the female sitting by the river, and there's a teacher sitting across the river, but there's that convergence. And where that convergence happens, it's a very dynamic energy that emerges. And I might even suggest that as you wash your face and brush your teeth tonight, imagine that you're being blessed by those waters. It can happen anytime, any place. So, and we're purifying ourselves of our transgressions, and we're asking for forgiveness and clarity and purification. Now, Murshid says this, its symbology is this, that the water which rises from the top of the Himalayas is like a spring of love coming from the heart. That which rises from the heart is the first place of pilgrimage. That rises from the heart is the first place of pilgrimage. Then it goes on like the holy rivers of the Ganges and Yamuna. And the place where the rivers meet is called Sangam. S-A-N-G-A-M, Sangam. Which means sympathy. And where the river reaches the sea, it's called unity. Unity with God. It's a beautiful picture of life, which one can observe in this symbolic form. So think of that as you breathe from the heart and the energy flows up and comes down again. And you think of it as merging and crossing. Pirvalayat, when we used to do the alternate nostril breathing in retreat with him, he worked with the leaders and worked with these esoteric practices, gave us that breath of thinking of that breath going like that, making that serpentine motion around and touching the chakras. But then when you do the both nostrils together, it does this. And it touches those chakras and activates them. And this is, of course, this idea of sympathy with another. It comes when we're with someone, we maybe feel something in our heart, or we feel something in our solar plexus, or we feel something in our throat, you know, or our forehead. I mean, these centers can be activated in the presence of other friends and companions and teachers, certainly. Just a little bit more, and then we'll work with another practice before we close. If interpreted rightly, we could have the sacred pilgrimage to the Ganges here and everywhere. The sacred river is the sympathy coming out of our own heart and reaching towards God in the perfection, the spiritual attainment. And so I wanted to work with the practice, Ishq Allah, Mabood Allah. Ishq Allah, Mabood Allah. But I want to work with each word of this practice individually, and then we'll bring it together. So the first word, Ishq, I-S-H-Q or I-S-H-K, you can see it sometimes. Ishq. Ishq is this unconditional love, divine love. It's this love that is filled with the desire to know God deeply. I thought it was timely, and I'll share it with you today in the Murshid Sam's Bowl of Saki commentary. He said this. He asked the question, and what is Ishq? And he answers, it is the essential quality with which characterizes the personality of God. It is the essential quality which characterizes the personality of God, so that God is not only emptiness, but also has absolute fullness. It's a very beautiful thought. And in Sufi dialectics debate, if you've read some, especially the older scholars that debate the different streams of Sufism, you know, they talk about the subject and the object. It becomes this dialectical, you know, expression. So emptiness, we could think, is complete objectivity and openness. Perhaps maybe beyond all meaning and form, and of course, absolute fullness, then this expression comes in to all names and forms. It's both. It's neither this nor that, it's this and that. So Ishq, this unconditional, all-consuming love. Oh, it's good to know. Also, Ishq means vine. Vine. What happens when a vine grows on your fence or a vine grows on your tree? What happens? It's all-consuming. Doesn't it just take over the fence or take over the tree? It starts wrapping itself around it. And it becomes part of it. That's what Ishq is. God so enfolds us, and we also in turn have the desire to embrace God to the extent that we have that, inshallah, God willing, a unitive experience. So think of that, Ishq Allah. So you can almost think of that also as that serpentine motion that we just talked about, of wrapping and unfolding, touching the chakras with Ishq, Ishq, Ishq. So now let's say Ishq. And we'll do that also, 11, 11, and 11 for 33. When we're doing our daily practice, it's advised to do 101. So 34 aloud, 34 on the breath, and 33 silently completes the cycle of 101. So let's do Ishq aloud. Ishq, 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 Ishq. Feel it arising from the heart, this beautiful vine, this connectedness, and whisper, Ishq, Ishq. Breathe in, Ishq, and out, Ishq, 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 Ishq. now silently. The next word is to this sacred phrase is Ma'bud. No, I'm sorry. It's Allah, Ishq Allah. And of course, Allah is divine presence. Just tuning into that presence. So now we say Allah 11 times. And these sounds, sort of notice or put them in the heart and get the heart vibrating. Ma'bud. 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 I'm so sorry. We're supposed to be doing Allah. Let's go back again. It's Allah. Allah. Ishq Allah. We're going to use just Allah. Let's go. Allah. 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 Now whisper. Now silently breathing in Allah and out Allah. Allah. And the next word is Ma'bud. Ma'bud. Ma'bud is the one that we seek, the one that we adore, the one that we're devoted to. Ma'bud, the beloved. Constant yearning and searching for the beloved. Ma'bud. And now we do that 11 times. And again, notice what's happening in the heart. Ma'bud. Ma'bud, 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 Ma'bud. Now we whisper. And silently, the one that we adore, that we love, that we have a passionate yearning for, devotion to, Ma'bud. Now, one more time. Allah. 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 And whisper. Silently. And now we are work with the whole phrase together. With Ishq, we feel this spark or emergence from the heart. And Mabud, it's like that vine that's reaching towards to envelop, to enclose, to embrace that which we call beloved, that which we feel is worthy of our worship and our adoration. And then we say, what is that? It's God, it's Allah. And then so the Ishq starts it. Then the Allah, we're searching for Allah, we're calling out. Mabud, we remind ourselves of this yearning for union, this devotion that leads us to that union, this sense of adoration that uplifts us towards that union. And then we call out again, Allah. It's interesting, isn't it, that that word, Allah, God, emerges twice in this phrase, twice. Think about it. There's some interesting mystery to rhythm, numbers, sequencing. You know, think about it. Think about it deeply. So we're going to say, we're going to do this one, the whole 101. The first 34 aloud, the next 34 whispering, and the last 33 silent. Ishq Allah, Mabud Allah. 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 Ish Allah, Ma'bud 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 Allah. Now we say it on a whisper and we breathe in. Ish Allah, Ma'bud Allah. Ish Allah, Ma'bud Allah. Ish Allah, Ma'bud Allah. Ish Allah, Ma'bud Allah. Now silently, you can breathe in the whole phrase, just carry it on the breath. You can breathe in Ishq Allah, Ma'bud Allah, and then out Ishq Allah, Ma'bud Allah. Ishq Allah, Mabud Allah. If you will allow me, I'd like to close this session in a rather unconventional way. We usually close with one of Anayat Khan's prayers, Pure Mercy prayers, but I don't think you'll mind. I was inspired to share this with you. I think we're all aware of the works of St. Francis, Pope, well, he probably will be another St. Francis, but Pope Francis. And during his assignment, his office as Pope, he has been compelled to issue what's called encyclical letters. Encyclical letters are letters that are to all, not only all members of the Catholic Church, but really all of humanity who wants to consider the message. Now, the last one that he offered was a week ago, about a week ago on October 3rd. And he offered this or signed it and gave it in Assisi, where St. Francis lived and did his practice, along with St. Clair. But the first one was given on in May in 2015. And the recent letter was called The Brotherhood and Sisterhood of Every Human Being and Social Friendship. That was the title. The Brotherhood and Sisterhood of Every Human Being and Social Friendship. The first one, however, of which I'd like to read the close, which is a kind of beautiful prayer, I hope you'll think so as well, was called The Letter on Care for Our Common Home. The titles in them of themselves is incredibly beautiful, I think. The Letter on the Care of Our Common Home. And this was the very last section of this letter. You can find these just by searching for encyclical letters of Pope Francis. The Vatican website will come up and they're offered in every language. This is what he says, and I offer this as our closing prayer. God of love, show us our place in this world as channels of your love for all the creatures of this earth, for not one of them is forgotten in your sight. Enlighten those who possess power and money, that they may avoid the sin of indifference. Here the word indifference is of that more contemporary meaning, like, I just don't care about you, I'm indifferent. So enlighten those who possess power and money, that they may avoid the sin of indifference, that they may love the common good, advance the weak, and care for this world in which we live. The poor and the earth are crying out. O Lord, seize us with your power and light. Help us to protect all life, to prepare for a better future, for the kingdom of your, for the coming of your kingdom of justice, peace, love, and beauty. Praise to you. Amen.